Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early. Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Karen Reed back in court again today, and we're going to take you right there for all of the coverage of what's going on in that courtroom and the follow-ups with Judge Beverly Cannone. Let's go there right now.
All right, the court, please. Yay. All persons have any business before the Honorable Beverly Cannone, Justice of the Norfolk Superior Court and before the County of Norfolk. Draw near, raise your attendance, and you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is now open. You may be seated.
22-117, the Commonwealth versus Karen Reed. Can I please identify yourself for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Gotham for Commonwealth.
Good morning, Mr. Gotham.
I'm Gotham for Commonwealth.
Good morning, Mr. Lally.
Good morning, Your Honor. Hank Brennan for the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Mr. Brennan.
Good morning, Your Honor. Al Jackson from the street.
Good morning, Mr. Jackson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Elizabeth Little, also on behalf of Ms. Reed.
Good morning, Ms.
Little. Morning, Your Honor. Robert Alessi for Ms. Reed.
Mr. Lessie.
And good morning, Your Honor. David Gennetti for Karen.
Good morning, Mr. Gennetti. Good morning, Mr. Gennetti. All right, so we've got a few things to cover today. I've got a couple of questions to finish off about the defense position on the opposition to excluding the ACCA witnesses. Then we'll go on to defendant's motion to exclude Mr. Crosby. Dr. Crosby, and then we'll go on to the defendant's motion to exclude Robert Gilman. I know they're both under docket grounds, and we'll hear about that. And the Commonwealth's motion for sanctions. And we have newly filed a motion to amend the scheduling order so that we don't hear the motion to dismiss today, and in opposition to that. And a motion to reconsider part of my prior ruling regarding the tapes at the Canton Police Station video. So that's the order that makes sense to me to finish up what we already had scheduled last week. If you can look for anything else. So the questions that I have. Oh, before we start, so I want it to be very clear, counsel knows this. There has been some attempt at distinction between defense counsel. Mr. Gennetti wasn't on the emails. Ms. Little wrote the pleadings that everyone signed. Mr. Lessie's late to the game here. But you all know that when one of you speak for the entirety of the defense team. When one of you act for the entirety of the defense team. And when one of you makes representations or misrepresentations, you speak for the entire defense team. You know that. Do you understand that, Mr. Gennetti?
I do, Your Honor.
Mr. Jackson?
Of course.
Ms. Little?
Yes.
And Mr. Lessie?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, each attorney is legally accountable for the actions and statements of the entire team. So now the questions that I have, Mr. Alessi, that you said welcome questions, and I appreciate that. So I wanted to talk a little about that pause email that you called. Could you stand, please, because I have to
address. Yes, I was going to go to the podium.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. I didn't want to stand while you were talking.
You could stand. All right, so the pause email is you call it. So first of all, we have that Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, 10:49 a.m. email from Mr. Jackson. Dear Dr. Wolf, thank you so much for taking the time to get on the phone with me this morning. Pursuant to our conversation, please feel free to forward an engagement letter to this email address. You will get that countersigned and returned to you forthwith, along with your retainer as required. Also, if you could attach a copy of your, Dr. Rentschler's, and Mr. Klein's CVs, I would appreciate it. I look forward to speaking to you and your team soon as we iron out the logistics for your participation in the trial. Thank you again, AJ. Then, as you pointed out, 2 days later, an email from Daniel Wolf to Mr. Jackson regarding Reed engagement, and that's the title of the other one. Subsequent to our conversation on Wednesday, the U.S. District Attorney's Office has asked that we pause on any further conversation until we receive additional information from their office regarding our involvement moving forward. I will provide you an update when I have it. Thanks, Dan. You called that a pause email, but when I was looking through my notes, what you said was, based on that pause email, I infer that there was no further discussion between Acker and Mr. Jackson regarding compensation and retainer, and then out of the blue, the bill arrives. So my question to you is, are you inferring, or do you know that to be fact, that there was no conversation, emails, texts, letters, phone calls? Do you know that to be fact, or is that what you are inferring, as you said?
I am inferring, Your Honor. I do not know that as a fact.
Okay. So now my next question is regarding the invoice and the payment or fact of payment. So the invoice was provided on February 13th, 2025, provided to the Commonwealth. The bill itself was paid on July 25th, 2024. Why wasn't the record of payment produced at the same time?
Same time as what, Your Honor?
As the invoice.
And you're referring to the record of payment being...
Yes, why wasn't the fact that this payment was made? It didn't come out, for me, at least for the court, until I asked you midway through your proceedings. And in fact, I have the opposite. I have filed after that February 13th date, and I know Ms. Little filed something yesterday to clarify this. It seems pretty clear. This was filed, I believe, on the weekend, February 16th. Defendant's opposition to the Commonwealth's motion to exclude employees of ARCA. The Commonwealth's motion to exclude these exculpatory expert witnesses who were not hired or paid for by the defense is not made in good faith in a desperate and transparent attempt to keep exculpatory testimony of neutral expert witnesses from reaching the jury in this case. Going on to the next page. Ironically, the Commonwealth accuses the defendant of failing to comply with her discovery obligations while conceding that the information is not in her care, custody, or control. Moreover, here, the defense has gone above and beyond its reciprocal discovery obligations and has already satisfied all of its mandatory discovery obligations under Rule 14 and turned over all additional information in the control and custody of the defense relating to the ARCA witnesses, as ordered by the court at the last hearing, in spite of the fact that the defendant's reciprocal discovery is not yet due. How do you reconcile that?
I
had to ask you midway through your presentation whether that bill was paid.
I'm going to answer it, Your Honor. I just want to make sure you were finished with your question. I learned that that invoice was paid Sunday night before February 18th. I'm going to repeat that.
Again, what you know and what all counsel know is one and the same.
I understand, Your Honor. So I'm answering your question. That's part one of the answer. When that was submitted on the 16th, I had not gone and done my investigation and gone through and asked all the questions that I did. So that's part one. Part two of the answer is, Your Honor, you've referenced that I didn't get to the payment until the middle of my presentation. The reason is because I did my presentation in chronological order. And that's the notebook that I laid out. I started with March, went all the way through, and when I got to the invoice, before I could state that it was paid, Your Honor asked the question, was it paid? And my answer was, right away, yes, It was paid, and I said, and that's what I was going to get to next. So the reason why it came out when it did is because I did the whole presentation in chronological order.
But the motion, defendant's opposition to the Commonwealth's motion to exclude, for to exclude employees of ACCA, is signed by you.
Your Honor, it is signed by me, but if I could, with regard to 3.3A1, 3.3A1 is not a strict liability statute. That's the reason why it has knowing in it, is in order to violate 3.3A1, the attorney in question has to know with regard to the fact in issue. So respectfully, Your Honor, I have a different view of what an attorney is responsible for under 3.3A1. You're absolutely correct. Under everything else, particularly Rule 14, it can be no excuse for any attorney, including me, that I didn't know what was happening in discovery. That's not the way Rule 14 works. I am responsible for everybody. But, Your Honor, it's clear in the commentary, it's clear in the case law. The reason why knowing is with regard to each attorney is no attorney can be responsible for the statements of issues of fact in court when it comes to a 3.3A1 analysis. That analysis in construction, Your Honor, would render mere surplusage and read out the mens rea of knowing. In something that critical of candor to the court, that's why they put the mens rea in, because no attorney can be responsible for a misstatement of fact of another attorney unless they have knowledge of the misstatement and they knowingly participate. So I respectfully have a different conclusion than Your Honor does about attorneys being responsible for statements on candor under 3.3A from everything else in the world, which I agree completely with Your Honor.
All right. I'm not going to ask other counsel. All right. So let's move on to the next motion.
Your Honor, if I could, the tabs that I had, I've marked them as exhibits. I didn't do that last time.
The white book?
The white book, and I had it marked. Mr. Brennan has agreed to them going. May I just offer them in at this time? They're all marked. There are two. Your Honor's February 6th was exhibit one, so I picked off on two and worked it out before. What would you like me to do with these, Your Honor?
You can hand them to the court officer who will hand them to...
Well, there you are. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Have you concluded what you...
Yes, but let's
okay.
All right. So let's go on to your... Did the Commonwealth want to add anything?
No, thank you, Your Honor.
All right. So let's go on. I don't have to use the gym. 499. So the motion of the defendant to exclude the testimony of the Commonwealth's witness, James Crosby. And I've read it. I read it 2 weeks ago when it came in, Mr. Lessing. I'll hear you on your motion.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm just getting myself reoriented. Thank you.
Court.
The entire proposed testimony of Dr. Crosby should be excluded because he is plainly not qualified to render the opinions that he is trying to render, and his methodology not only is not reliable, but it's not even documented. Your Honor well knows the inquiry under Daubert-Lanigan So I won't go through Rantala and the rest. Your Honor's heard it many times before. Under the qualifications prong, the crucial inquiry, Your Honor set the standard for the subject matter of his testimony. And what is the subject matter of his testimony? The subject matter of his proposed testimony is the medical cause of the injuries and wounds to the right arm of the decedent. I'm going to get into how Dr. Crosby tries to camouflage to avoid the impact of the standard Your Honor established. But that is clearly what he is trying to do. And I cite to NDAO 1377, NDAO 1382, because that is where he renders his opinions. For example, he says, this is a preliminary response to your request for my professional expert opinion, regarding injuries and defects to the right arm of decedent John O'Keefe. Similar statements. So it's very clear that's the subject matter of his testimony. Your Honor stated with regard to Dr. Rentschler that it is clear to me that in Massachusetts, biomechanical engineers are not qualified to testify as to medical causation of an injury. Point. Only an MD can do that. That's what Your Honor said was the clear law in Massachusetts. Admittedly, indisputably, Dr. Crosby is not a medical doctor. As a matter of fact, Dr. Crosby is not a veterinarian. He's not a forensic odontologist. And those are all disciplines that can even get near the type of subject matter that he's looking to opine about. He tries to dodge that very impactful standard that Your Honor established by saying, well, you know, this case is not about the treatment of the decedent. It's not a case about the treatment of the wounds on the right arm. And yeah, you have to be a medical doctor to treat, but that's not what the issue is, so I'm okay. It is a total straw man argument. He's creating this treatment. Nobody ever said the way that the issue is treatment. Dr. Russell never said treatment. Dr. Crosby made it up. So he creates this straw man to try to avoid the medical causation opinion that he is given. And I think that's a clear indication that he is very, very sensitive to the issue that he's not a medical doctor. With regard to his area of expertise, it can't be more obvious than his own proclamations. He says the name of his consulting group is Canine Aggression. His purported title is Certified Behavior Consultant. So he himself dubs himself with regard to canine behavior. And that is what he is expert in. And of course, there's no issue whatsoever in this case about canine behavior. And more importantly, his own report doesn't discuss canine behavior at all. So in conclusion, on the qualifications prong, Your Honor, based upon Your Honor's standard, he's not a medical doctor. He's therefore not qualified to opine on the cause of the wounds to the decedent's right arm. The court need go no further than the qualifications prong to exclude all of his testimony, because all of his report is regarding the cause of the wounds to the decedent's right arm. And it almost is common sense that when someone is trying to opine on the cause, the medical cause of injury, that if you're not a doctor with regard to the issue, that you're not qualified. So now let's go to the methodology of Dr. Crosby. His methodology is essentially he took measurements of one dog, a dog named Chloe, that it purports to be Chloe. He didn't document that it was. There's no documentation of that. But let's assume, hypothetically, it is this dog, Chloe. So what does he do? He takes measurements. This is what he did first, and I'm going to get to what he's just recently submitted. So what does he do? He takes measurements, anesthetizes the dog, takes measurements of the teeth, and then he takes those measurements and he tries to apply them to photographs of the decedent's right arm. And he basically says in his methodology, I am measuring the distance between the canines, I'm taking other measurements of the dog's dentition, and then I'm going to compare them to the decedent's right arm in a photograph, and I am going to opine that the measurements of the dentition don't match up with the measurements and distance of the wounds on the right arm. Therefore, this dog couldn't have caused these injuries, and therefore these wounds are not caused by a dog, and this dog, so he says not only not Chloe, but no dog. Then he goes even further and he says, and I believe the cause is some sharp object. So now we have him going even beyond a dog, and he's claiming that it was caused by a sharp object. It just goes to show you how far he is afield of what he is doing. So he's not a medical doctor, so he's now performing essentially another diagnosis of the wounds to a human. He provides zero evidence of any experience in determining whether a wound on a human is caused by a dog or a sharp object. And his methodology, Your Honor, is remarkable for several other reasons. First, he uses a hospital wristband to take his measurements because the photographs of the autopsy didn't have the ABFO ruler in them. So he tries to use the wristband as a surrogate for his measurements. He provides no support whatsoever for using that surrogate. And what do I mean by support, Your Honor? For an expert to justify a methodology, they've got two ways to do it. The most prominent and common is that the methodology is generally accepted in the relevant scientific or medical field. He provides zero, and I mean zero, words to tether his methodology to a commonly accepted practice, meaning his methodology that he used, he doesn't show any support for that at all, let alone it's commonly accepted. He doesn't cite to one study, he doesn't cite to one scientific publication that says this is a permissible way to determine whether a bite is from a dog. So the burden, as Your Honor knows, is on the Commonwealth to establish the methodology. And I note, Your Honor, that the Commonwealth, in its first response, states in the third paragraph, Dr. Crosby engaged in recognized methodology to study the abrasions on John O'Keefe's arm. What recognized methodology? Where is it? It's not in his report, and it's not even in the opposition. So they try to brush over with a conclusory statement, Dr. Crosby engaged in recognized methodology, when it's nowhere in their opposition. Where's the recognition for it? That dooms completely their second prong of Daubert. Then what they say about methodology in the same paragraph, they say the methodology employed was based on facts, science, and study. What do they cite to? They cite back to Exhibit 1, which is his report, which has not one footnote, not one reference in his report to support it. So the statement the methodology employed was based on fact, science, and study is a bald conclusion with no support at all. And this was the opportunity for the Commonwealth, I put it pretty clearly what the challenge was, for them to come back and say, oh, no, no, the methodology, it's recognized, and here is the basis for it. It gets worse for the Commonwealth, Your Honor, on the methodology, because there are potentially some methodologies that might be used. They're called into serious question. But one of them for humans, not for dogs, is what the ABHO talks about is the dental mode and overlay method. And that is basically take a mold of dentition, and in the most recent submission, the Commonwealth put in, very belatedly, but I can deal with it, that Dr. Crosby now says he took molds of the dog's teeth. And so I'm going to accept arguendo that he did that, and he did it correctly. But what he misses is those molds are meaningless unless you come to part two. You've got to take those molds and compare it to something. And the something is what's called the overlay method. And what is the overlay method? And this is all set forth in our opposition, and I've got citations to the exhibits, which I'm going to go to. The overlay method is the part two you apply the mold to. So what you do is you take tissue samples of the wound and you make, and there's a variety of techniques you can do, but you basically create the wound on a model and then you compare the mold to the model to see if they match up or don't match up. He never engaged in the second part of what is, even with two parts, is a questionable methodology. He doesn't employ the overlay method, the part two. So you, the molds that he took are meaningless unless you have the overlay to go with it, because that's what you compare them to. More importantly, the ABHO makes it clear that the only people that can do that are forensic odontologists. And even then, the science is very questionable. What he also does in terms of, and also for his methodology, where it's just a measurement, he provides zero citations, and the Commonwealth provides zero support for taking measurements in molds and comparing them to the womb. Zero. So what are the other errors of Dr. Crosby? And these are not mere differences of opinion, Your Honor. These go right to the methodology. And we put in an affidavit of Dr. Russell, who is the medical support for his errors. So Dr. Russell goes through and talks about all the errors that Dr. Crosby caused in his analysis. The first, she says, is that he treated the arm of the decedent as if it is a static, plastic mannequin-like object. And what is meant by that? Your Honor may recall Dr. Russell stated that when anyone is attacked by a dog, they move their arm, they flex their arm, and they move it, etc. And that can cause a dog's teeth to have an incomplete bite, etc. Dr. Crosby doesn't account at all for that movement. So what he did was he treated the arm as if it never moved, and then he said, I'm going to take the dog's teeth, measure it, and then I'm going to take those measurements to a static arm. And he says it's just the distance is too far off to say that it was from any dog. Well, what he didn't account for is that when the arm flexes up, as it always happens in a defensive wound mode, those angles and those distances change. They get closer together. It's common sense, but it's also medically supported by Dr. Russell. And she said when you do that flex, that that is going to make those wounds approximate the canine. But the fact is, her main point is, he never accounted for that in his methodology. It's not an opinion. It's a methodology. So, it again, if he were to cite to a study that would say, no, no, it's okay to just treat it illogically as a static object, he might have some support. But he doesn't, and there is nothing in the literature, because nobody believes that's at all realistic in a dog attack. So that's her first criticism of him. She also states that the photos that he used, there's no documentation of who took them, how they took them, and we all know in forensic photography, those people who take those photographs have to be trained, they have to give a fair and accurate depiction, and you can look at one of the key photos, it's blurred. So it's obvious that there's a problem with one of the photos. She also aptly points out that there's not one citation in his report to any support for anything that he did. The Commonwealth, in their opposition, spent more words going back trying to attack Dr. Russell than they did trying to support their own expert's opinion. And I just counted the lines. I'm not going to tell you what the count is, but there's more lines basically trying to say that Dr. Russell's entire testimony and opinions lacked adequate authority. My. She had, I think, 31 footnotes in her report. The one who entire opinions lacked adequate authority is Dr. Crosby. The other criticism that she has on the methodology of Dr. Crosby is that he didn't account for the dimpling and pinching and piercing of skin. Human skin, when there's any pressure, particularly with a bite, it moves, it dimples, it hits the muscles, etc., etc. He gave no account for the condition of human arm and skin and anatomy, perhaps because he's not a medical doctor and doesn't know the area. So, with regard to the Commonwealth's response, I'm appreciative of the fact that they cited to his thesis. So what they say is, in the second paragraph, they said his master thesis, the specific use of evidence in the investigation of fatal dog attacks, has been peer reviewed. So what did I do? I went and read both of his theses. What I found is particularly probative of the issues I just raised. So I looked at I read 179 pages of his 2016 Master of Science thesis that they cited. In it, he talks about, on page 46, defining bite mark evidence. A bite mark can be generally defined as a pattern made by teeth in a substrate. A dog bite injury is a pattern industry. Your Honor may recall the absolute probing of Dr. Russell on patterns and the arguments that patterns are a soft science and you can't rely upon them. And lo and behold, Dr. Crosby's first sentence in his master's thesis is a bite mark can generally be defined as a pattern. A dog bite injury is a pattern injury. So I appreciate in his thesis that he confirms Dr. Russell's methodology. What he doesn't do in his thesis is even mention his own methodology that he used here. In 179 pages, there is now one reference to the methodology he used in his report. With regard to I mentioned the ABFO, the American Board of Forensic Odontology, and I mentioned how difficult that is to do that correctly. In his thesis, he states, and I quote on page 61, "The guidelines, however, do not indicate the criteria necessary for using each method to determine whether the bite mark can be related to a person's dentition and with what degree of probability. There is no science on the reproducibility of the different methods of analysis that lead to conclusions about the probability of a match." A very, very, and I couldn't agree with Dr. Crosby more on that. He then talks about, in his thesis, about the fact that there's no accepted methodology for dog bites, even using ABFO. And on page 63, I'm going to quote what he says. "Although the ABFO does not specifically address animal bites, it would be logical to apply the same standards to forensic examination of dogs." And what is that standard? That's the mold in the overlay, right? He never did the overlay, and he was proposing in his thesis that that might be a way to go, but he recognizes that it is not reliable. And then on page 66, the last paragraph I'll cite in this, he says, "Reliability in human cases is under examination. Hard statistical agreement on consistency is not present, so each evaluator will have to make the best argument in each case. As case law develops and examination science progresses, we can hope that standards will be established and accepted. Until then, a forensic bite evaluator can best develop their opinion on based on whether the bite mark in question is consistent or inconsistent with a pool of potential subjects established by other means." Here we go. This opinion should be heavily influenced by supportive hard evidence, such as DNA, physical observation, blood, tissue recovered from the gastrointestinal tract, and other factors. So the ABO, he agrees with the fact that you just, even with this methodology, you've got to have it supported by this hard evidence that he doesn't have anywhere near in his methodology. And what he also talks about is relying upon a medical examiner for this hard evidence. And what we point out in our opposition, Your Honor, he never worked with a medical examiner for his methodology. He never worked with a forensic odontologist. In the case law that we point out, even in this very suspect area of bite mark analysis, even in the cases that allow it for humans, they are all cases where there had to be a forensic odontologist or a medical examiner involved for quite obvious reasons. So his master's thesis supports the methodology of Dr. Russell and provides not one mention of his methodology. So then I said, well, maybe in his PhD thesis, which is more recent, 2023, maybe in that thesis that the Commonwealth did not cite. So I went and read 143 pages of that, and there is zero mention of his methodology, and that was just 2 years ago. So what does he say? In his whole thesis is entitled "Dog Bite Related Human Fatalities: A Scientific Study." So it's really about fatalities, and here it's undisputed that the decedent, you know, his death wasn't caused by a dog. It's a dog attack, but that was not the cause of death. And his whole thesis is about the problem statement. He defines his thesis on page 18. "One of the problems is the lack of standardization of methods and reporting. Lack of standardization manifests in several ways." So basically what he did in his thesis is he went through and talked all about when there's fatalities, there's ways, and he creates a classification system on page 63. But his classification is on behavior. Second sentence, page 63. "Classifying dog bites. This provided the opportunity to develop a protocol for classifying the incident from the dog's likely perspective based on its behavior." That's his thesis. It's got nothing to do with, is this wound caused by a dog bite? And so on the point of needing a medical examiner, needing someone like a forensic pathologist to be involved. He agrees. Page 125 of his PhD thesis, first full paragraph. Where possible, medical examiners or other examining experts should document the location extent of wounds and try to determine which wounds may have been antemortem, perimortem, postmortem. This may require histological analysis by a forensic pathologist. So he mentions what medical examiners should do, what a forensic pathologist should do. He doesn't even begin to suggest that he should do it or that he is even qualified to do it. So in sum, Your Honor, with regard to Dr. Crosby, whose degree is in veterinary science, I don't know what that is. Dr. Russell doesn't know what that is. It's certainly not a veterinarian, although if one reads it quickly, one might think that's what it is. He's not. He was a police officer for 22 years. And even then, he wasn't like a canine police officer. He had an interest in them then. And it wasn't until he retired that he became active in dog behavior and how dogs behave, if they're aggressive, etc., etc. So why is it, Your Honor, that we respectfully submit that he cannot testify with regard to the subject matter of his report, which is the medical cause of the wounds on the decedent's right arm? He's not a medical doctor. He's not a forensic odontologist. He's not a veterinarian. He has none of the qualifications to do that, and he surely doesn't have any qualifications to say it wasn't a dog, but it's a sharp object. And then with regard to his methodology, he doesn't document at all how that methodology is generally accepted. He doesn't even, nor does the Commonwealth even talk about the non-exclusive Daubert factors and how they might satisfy that alternative. And lastly, when he speaks and writes a master's thesis and a PhD thesis of just 2 years ago, he doesn't even mention the methodology that he used. So, Your Honor, in Your Honor's opinion about Dr. Russell, stated that it was a close call for Dr. Russell in her ability to testify. Since it was a close call for Your Honor, I believe it is as distant a call as possibly could be made with Dr. Crosby. So I respectfully request that he be excluded. There's no need for a Daubert hearing. It's plain on the papers, and it's not something that is curable. The Commonwealth tried to submit very recently a mold. Interestingly, they never tried to document the methodology, tether it to study, show that it was recognized. They've now had two tries at it, and they haven't come close, and I'd urge the court to reject it. A jury should not have to hear from a dog behavioralist on what was the cause of the wounds to the right arm of the deceased.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Brennan, before you begin, Dr. Crosby is not going to testify that this injury appeared to have been caused by some sharp object, is he? Are you planning on bringing that in?
I wouldn't ask him to do that, no.
Okay. All right, so I'm hearing the motion.
Yeah?
Yes.
Mr. Alesi tries to point out differences between Dr. Russell and Dr. Crosby, and there's always going to be differences between experts. One difference is that Dr. Crosby has actually testified in state and federal courts regarding dog bites before, where Dr. Russell never had before this case. And so in preparation for Dr. Russell, we provided not only a CV, a history of his education, but also an actual report. Actual report of what Dr. Crosby did, the methodology explaining his analysis, his examination of Chloe, and his testing. And that was provided to the defense prior to any testimony that he will have on the stand. When we look at the summary that's provided, Dr. Crosby has testified in numerous cases before. So those courts seem to disagree with Mr. Alesi's opinion. In addition, Dr. Crosby set out in his package numerous different journals and publications that he relied upon in this case. There are a number of publications, I won't read them all to the court, but we can see that he relied on books regarding bite mark evidence, human bites versus dog bites, forensic study of dog attacks on humans, a focus on bite mark analysis. The list is comprehensive. Variable mechanisms of dog-related deaths, life-threatening dog attacks, a devastating combination of penetrating and blunt injuries, fatal and near-fatal animal bite injuries, on and on. These are materials that he has studied, he's familiar with. Dr. Crosby has the qualifications to testify, not simply because he's testified in state and federal courts before this case, but also because of his studies and his education. It seems as though Attorney Alesi is trying to bind the court regarding a comment of the necessity for a medical doctor. There is no requisite that an expert in this field needs to be a medical doctor. And there is no cases that they provide that bind that limitation. The qualifications of Dr. Crosby are outstanding and significant. He studied at the College of Veterinary Medicine. He completed coursework in forensic animal behavior analysis, animal crime scene, bite mark analysis, veterinary forensic pathology, forensic crime scenes. He is often called to go to autopsies around the country to study wounds and determine if they are bite marks, if they are dog wounds, and if they can be attributed to a particular dog. He served as acting chief.
Is that in the papers?
The different autopsies he hasn't. I can supplement the autopsies he's been to, and I can also supplement specific cases where he's qualified. He has listed a number of cases in the back of his package.
So do I have the package? The exhibits that I have are attached to the Commonwealth's, the defendant's motion.
They have.
I don't know that I have all the reports.
Exhibit 1 has Dr. Crosby's report that has all this information in it.
Okay.
And as I mentioned on a previous tape, Dr. Crosby actually went and examined Chloe. And when he did that, he verified that it was in fact Chloe. He did mold of Chloe, and there was a subsequent report regarding those molds, which clearly demonstrate that the distance in those wounds are not anywhere near consistent with Chloe's spacing in his teeth.
So sort of as an aside, based on what Mr. Leslie argued, the verification that it was in fact Chloe, has the Commonwealth provided that information to the defense?
We have, and we can provide that as a supplement to the court, the verification of Chloe, and we can also provide to the court the bite mold analysis report of Dr. Crosby, which is not in this package.
I think that's attached here. I have the photographs.
That's part of the original report, but then he actually took a mold of Chloe's jaw and teeth, and then I asked him to supplement a report regarding the mold.
And that's been provided to the defense?
It has, but it has not been provided in this package, so I can provide that to the court.
Okay.
So I'll supplement those two different items for the court's reference. In addition to his experience, he was chief of animal care, protective services of the city of Jacksonville. He had oversight and approval of criminal investigations. He trained staff in dog bite and dangerous dog investigations. He served as the Animal Control Division Manager for Bay County, Florida from February 2008 to 2010. He has training and experience, including certifications in humane euthanasia of animals, legal restrictions of methods and reasons for euthanasia. He's investigated numerous complaints of dog bites and dog behavior. He's published. I had shown the book to Dr. Russell when she was cross-examined. He has a number of engagements where he teaches. Dr. Crosby is well-recognized in the field. He has employment in other projects other than his business. It includes a research associate canine brain project, 2023 to current. It's associated with Harvard University. Duties include the investigation and documentation of dog bite and related human fatalities. Also, division management consultant for Animal Care and Protective Services, City of Jacksonville, in 2016. He is a professional dog trainer, behavioral consultant. He has provided expert witness testimony in cases of dog bite, dog attack, dog-related fatalities. Now, in Dr. Crosby's report, he outlines his methodology, and you can see it is specific, it is detailed, it is consistent. And so when we compare, I'll refrain from getting into too much of a comparison, when we see the actual study of dog bites, we see something different in Dr. Crosby's report. They're not unsupported claims that change from time to time. You can see that there are the pictures of Mr. O'Keefe's arm, and we can see the band in which she used to measure. You can see multiple pictures of Chloe's jaw, mouth, teeth, canines, incisors, and then you can see that he has measured the distance of all of those teeth specifically. And then in his methodology, he outlines each group of lesions, specifically lesion group 1, lesion group 2. And then he goes into an analysis of the different groups of lesions. He explains why they are wholly inconsistent with both a dog bite and any animal bite. And he also describes and explains that the distance between the wounds are totally dissimilar to Chloe's mouth. He does look, as Mr. Lisi suggested, at other support, such as DNA. And in fact, he embraces other support. In this case, there is no canine DNA significant to Dr. Crosby, because in virtually every case, he finds canine DNA. So he does look to alternative sources. And mindful, there was pig DNA found. So it wasn't as if the sample was obliterated or destroyed and there was no materials available for testing. It's just the unfortunate consequence that there is no animal DNA. And so while there are different methods, and some of the things that Attorney Lisi spoke about, dentition, deal with human biting, not dog biting, his methodology is set out very clearly on how he came to these determinations, what he did in his study. He actually engaged in an investigation in this case before providing his opinions. So Dr. Crosby is well qualified. He has been accepted in state and federal courts before this case. He did a thorough examination. He has ample support for his training and experience, and his opinions are soundly based, not on hypothetical or rhetoric, but on the facts, on the details in this case. He has never changed his position from one event to another. It has always been the same in this report, has not wavered, and he is highly qualified to appear in this case in rebuttal if necessary, if Dr. Russell is to take the stand and provide some or any of the opinions that she provided before.
All right, so just to be clear, the Commonwealth does not intend, if I permit the testimony, does not intend to call him in your case in chief?
Absolutely not.
Okay. All right. Mr. Lessie, any follow-up?
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you.
And that is the latest from the courtroom and the hearing of Karen Reed today. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our conversations about this case, the hearings, and more. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.